Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Laura Romans, and today our producer, Elliot Bloom, and head of cinema, Tom Ohms, get into the American New Wave movement. This is to coincide with our re-release of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest through Odyssey Classics, which is our in-house distributor. New Hollywood was a transformative era in American cinema, spanning the late 1960s to the early 80s. We would see these young, rebellious directors replacing the old Hollywood system with bold, auteur-driven filmmaking. It was influenced by the European art cinema and the social upheavals of the time. And for the first time, they brought realism, ambiguity, and political awareness to the screen, kind of redefining what a mainstream movie could look like. It gave us classics like Bonnie and Clyde, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Easy Rider, The Godfather, Taxi Driver, and Network, so many more. It birthed the careers of many icons, including, of course, Jack Nicholson, Robert Redford, Francis Ford Coppola, Gina Rowlands, Elaine May, and even George Lucas. Elliot and Tom discussed the history of this movement and why it was so revolutionary for Hollywood. Here's Elliot and Tom.
So we're here to discuss the American New Wave or New Hollywood, but maybe good to give some context first as to why we're screening such a big program of these films. Of course, it's related to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but perhaps you could share a bit more.
This year at the Cannes Film Festival, we signed a contract for our distribution company to re-release One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in the Netherlands.
Odyssey Classics.
Odyssey Classics is the distribution company, and we're going to release it in the Benelux, so that's also Belgium and Luxembourg. We're releasing it now in November. It's the 50th anniversary. There's a 4K restoration made by the Academy Motion Pictures of Academy of Motion Pictures, and it looks amazing, and I think it's a very important film to re-release because it's about something we need right now, which is compassion.
Yes.
It's one of those classics that there's so much in it, you can look at it from any angle, really, and then see something that really reflects back on society now or...
And for context, what is the film about?
It's a film about a criminal played by Jack Nicholson, who plays a character, Randall McMurphy, who is put into a mental institution or a psychiatric ward because he's actually acting as though he's insane.
Yeah.
And the movie really questions what that is via the fact that he then gets put into a mental ward and is surrounded by these people who are deemed insane, and it's his interactions with these patients as he's trying to sort of avoid labor, and he gets into a almost sort of a epic struggle with the female nurse Ratchet, played by Louise Fletcher. It's very much a movie about systemic oppression and how to circumvent that or escape that or stand up against, well, in this case, not Uncle Sam, but Nurse Ratched. And yeah, so when we decided to re-release that, I thought it would be good to do a Nicholson retrospective. And while putting our Jack Nicholson retrospective together, I thought there are so many films. His career is very interesting. It started in New Hollywood in the 1960s, 70s, and then spans like all these decades to then for our program ends with The Departed, the Martin Scorsese movie, which is interesting because we'll come to Scorsese in his role inside the New Hollywood movement later on. But while putting that together, I thought, you have five easy pieces. You have Easy Rider. There are a couple of films in there that are really quintessentially New Hollywood, and we'll get into what New Hollywood stands for, that I thought maybe we should expand this even more and build around One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, not only the legacy of Jack Nicholson, but also the where Cuckoo's Nest fits into film history. And it is quintessentially a New Hollywood film. A foreign director making a movie very much about systemic oppression in the States, but then outside of the studio system. So that's a very long story about the contextualization of the movie that we're re-releasing. And yeah, we're now screening, I think, 15 films on one end in the Nicholson retrospective and almost the same amount in the New Hollywood. And they kind of overlap in a weird way.
And it also overlaps with Robert Redford, who recently passed away.
And it also overlaps with Diane Keaton passing away. So, there's something in the air.
And it's not death.
And it's not only death, no.
But it's interesting when you put this program together because I've watched One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I love it. But for me, it didn't necessarily immediately jump out at me as a typical American new Hollywood film, especially because of how well it did at the Oscars as well, even though maybe that's not the best way to measure whether it's part of it. But perhaps, should we start with what is new Hollywood?
By the way, just to point out, it was one of the three films ever to win the Big Five. So best actor, best actress, best screenplay, best director. And I'm forgetting one. Best picture. Yeah. Oh, geez.
Which year?
75.
75.
So what are the other two, Elliot? Quiz time.
Oh.
So there's one before and one after.
One after? I'm going to go Lord of the Rings, maybe?
No.
Really?
No. Did not win those Big Five ones.
I'm not going to. No.
Okay. So the one before is It Happened One Night by Frank Capra. The Fantastic Root movie.
Yeah.
And the one after that is Silence of the Lambs.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's so there's only three of them that did that. And I mean, we can debate if the Oscars are important in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
But I do think it then it does maybe reflect on this film as it feeling less grimy.
Even though
if you watch it now, it does very much feel like a cry for freedom or like a raised fist, you know, more than if you would look at it from the outside. That's why I also thought it was important to re-release it and maybe revisit it or see it for the first time for a younger audience for any audience really, to then realize like, oh, whoa, this has lasting value and is not a movie like... I don't know, maybe The English Patient or something you remember, like this sort of costume drama that then that won 13 Academy Awards and does maybe have a different place in film history, I guess.
And I think that's the important part, right, of not only this film, but the movement itself, how it relates to today, because as we're going to find out, it very much does. And hopefully we can find something there that can influence cinema today. Yeah. But yeah, as I said, what is New Hollywood or American New Wave?
Yeah, as I said before we started recording this podcast, the thing is, where do you start explaining this? Because it's hard to... I think New Hollywood and the emergence of it is very much one of those things when you're reading a history book. It's like, how did the Renaissance start? It's like it's waves of... it's rippling effects.
Yeah.
If you look at, for instance... Bonnie and Clyde by Arthur Penn is usually described as the first real new Hollywood movie.
What do you want to do with him then? Hang him. I don't know.
Take his picture. And then everybody's going to see Captain Frank Hammer of the Texas Rangers with the Barra Gang. Now, you know, we are just about the friendliest folks you would ever want to meet.
A movie that not necessarily celebrated violence, but had all the things that weren't really seen in old Hollywood for the longest time. So this is 1967. Thank you. It's a movie, incredibly violent. It was one of the most incredibly violent endings then ever recorded in cinema. It has sex. It has weird love triangles. It has new stars. It has Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway that you hadn't seen before doing all kinds of sexy, weird things. Very much a movie of its time. I think... the studio system in the late 50s was declining.
Yeah.
You used to have, I think they were called the Big Five, so Warner Brothers, Universal, I think it's MGM, and maybe RKO. I can't remember what the other old studios are called. And the system used to be that they had stars under contract for the long, sometimes for life. They made the best scripts and did everything in-house. It was their thing. They made the movie, they distributed it, and then they would also screen it in their own cinema.
So they ran a monopoly, basically.
Exactly. And due to multiple factors, whether it be like the post-war inflation, stuff like that, and also just, I think, the mores of the times really changing, the sexual revolution was slowly coming up. The 60s were this way more free time. There were movies produced in Europe that were very much funnily enough, inspired by the film noirs of the 40s, but then made by people like Godard and Antonioni. Yeah. And they were very much revolutionizing cinema. Those movies traveled to an America that was producing these throwaway big films that nobody really was seeing because the younger audience wanted to see maybe foreign films.
Yeah.
So the studios were, I think, very much needed to find a new way of doing things. And for some reason, they decided to make a buck to distribute films that were then produced independently. And maybe you can take over if you want.
Well, yeah, it was more that they decided to give more freedom to directors because they were seeing that these big productions not only were costing them a lot of money, but didn't have the same...
It's always about money, eventually.
Which is also the end or the demise of New Hollywood, which we'll find out a bit later. Yeah. But I think from what I understand, it's that, right? So it was deemed unlawful for them to hold exclusivity rights over their films to be screened at theatres. And that was kind of one of the main inflection points that encouraged them to sort of break themselves up a bit or try something different. Mm. So they give directors a bit more freedom. And as you were saying, not only with the sort of sexual revolution and sort of the 1960s being this very sort of, revolutionary moment, but we also, Film Studies 101, this was also the decline of the Hays Code, which was started in the 1920s and basically had, it was like a Christian conservative list basically of what could be allowed in film and what isn't allowed in film. And it was very clear or arbitrary of good and evil, no sex scenes, this kind of
no
stuff.
No toilets. That's the funny thing. We're now screening Psycho and, you know, it's revolutionary for showing you, I think, the first time ever, at least it's the seat. I think it's the first time you see the toilet seat. Yeah. Because, oh my God, maybe there was an ass on that. Like, it's, the Hays Code is the... At one point, the Hays Code is very interesting. We don't need to sort of cling to this, but I think the Hays Code is very interesting because if you look at film noirs, because the censorship was so incredibly harsh, you couldn't show a boob, you couldn't show real violence. Everything needed to be implied.
Yeah,
it actually worked pretty well for some movies, but
Hitchcock.
Exactly. Yeah.
He would often for sex scenes, he would just show a train going through a tunnel.
To
come back to what I was saying, as you were saying, how it's sort of influenced and there's ripples, especially from Europe, just to show you how much influence there was or a connection. Bonnie and Clyde, the writers, I believe David Newman and Robert Benton, they were obsessed with French New Wave, so much so that once they wrote the script for Bonnie and Clyde, they asked first François Truffaut to direct it. He didn't want to. Then Godard, who said that he couldn't function in a big studio system, but they were very much
surely you couldn't.
But he was very much inspired, or they were very much inspired by that. And I mean, the 1960s is a point where you see across over Europe, and then later in the 70s, 80s, arrest around other countries of new waves redefining what cinema can be.
Yeah, and I think it's very important what you said about film studies, the generation of filmmakers that will emerge and start the New Hollywood are especially what they now are called the movie brats. So it's Brian De Palma, Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas. Sorry if I'm forgetting somebody. And they are all in some capacity learning film by seeing film.
Yeah.
And then you can start clearly seeing the influence of, for instance, Kurosawa in eventually Star Wars or in the movies of Francis Ford Coppola. It's very interesting that it's the same thing with how much you can see Godard in Scorsese, for instance.
Yeah.
These are filmmakers that, you know, are much more than the sort of hired guns that used to work for the studio systems, like, George Cukor or Victor Fleming or these people that made Gone with the Wind and, you know, these are young brats. They're doing things differently. They are sucking up stuff and then regurgitating it to do something new, counterculturally relevant. You know,
it's funny that they're referred to as movie brats, but then in France, obviously Godard and Truffaut, they were part of the Cahiers du Cinéma and the critics. They were sort of seen as these very esteemed individuals who knew a lot about what they were writing on, and then went into film. We've talked a bit about sort of the origins of it, or what it's hard, obviously, to pinpoint exactly what ignited it. Obviously, mm-hmm. the social conditions and the state of cinema at the time. But perhaps it's also helpful to give an idea of what exactly is American New Wave.
Mm-hmm.
Of when I see a film, how can I tell that it's New Wave? What are the quintessential elements of it, would you say?
Oh, wow. Purely going by sentiment, I think that the major shift that you can feel between, I think, very much specifically Hollywood or American films before and after the the sort of switch here, the after Bonnie and Clyde, for instance, you can feel that it's gone from the representation or the glorification of the American dream.
Yes.
To I've passed the test. It's gone from the representation or the glorification of the American dream towards critiquing it or showing you the gritty side or showing you the reality of what is happening in America. And that reality is not fun. The interesting thing is that I think the studios for the longest time thought that people didn't want to see that in a theater.
Yeah.
They wanted to see entertainment. They wanted to see Ben-Hur. They wanted to see, you know, like big Singing spectacles. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And then you can clearly see just before this movement starts, they start like pouring out these big movies that they cost them like millions of dollars, like Tora Tora and Paint Your Wagon, all these films that nobody is, if you now mention these titles, everybody's like, what? What film is that? Even though there is one that everybody knows. One of the films just before this movement starts is The Sound of Music. It won all the awards. It gained Warner Brothers like millions of dollars. But it was one of the last vestiges of this kind of film. And after that, and that is, funnily enough, not a glorification of the American dream. It's also very much actually a war movie.
Yeah,
a movie
camaraderie or solidarity. Yeah.
But then if you look at something like Midnight Cowboy, for instance, or these films that then come after it, they are gritty. They are about drug use. They're about sex. They're about violence. They show a very much the darker side of, or that, not necessarily American nightmare, but maybe the American realism, reality, you know, the reality of what's happening.
Yeah. That's kind of basically it. No, but I think the films before it, right, the westerns, the musicals, etc., they're sort of almost either apolitical or propaganda in some way. There's a clear distinction of what's good and what's evil. It's often the foreigner or the outsider, mm-hmm. and they're often set in this like non-specific place of time. Here we see directors very much situated in the present day, in modern realities, and not only are they responding to what's happening or what they see around them of how, like you said, the American dream is not actually quite what it seems,
mm-hmm.
but they are having their own personal voice in it, and that's where we get a bit more experimental, let's say, because it'd be a bit weird if they were doing critiquing this whilst within the structures of a musical or a Western, although you do see a couple of like, what you can say, Midnight Cowboy, you could consider sort of a modernist Western.
I think genre is still there. I think if you look at, but it's used in a different way. If you look at, for instance, I think The Wild Bunch is very important in this because it also shows you a very...
Who's that by?
Sam Peckinpah. Editing-wise, for instance, we need to also look at the stylistic changes that are happening here. If you look at the ending, for instance, of the big shootout at the end of The Wild Bunch, or you look at the shootout at the end of Bonnie and Clyde, the editing there becomes so rapid.
Yeah,
there's which is a reference to jump cuts invented by, well, maybe not invented by Godard, but popularized by Godard or the French New Wave. So there's also a change stylistically in how things are portrayed. Same thing goes, for instance, with how John Cassavetes, very much one of the most important names in I would even say maybe not New Hollywood, but just generally in American independent cinema. The way that he shoots or edits is almost like you're watching a documentary, a movie like A Woman Under the Influence or The Killing of a Chinese Bookie or the movies that he made before that, Faces, Shadows, all made with his own money, his own distribution company and a production company. those films feel like they're so gritty, also because how they're shot, the stylistic glamour of films like, as we just said, like these big studio Hollywood movies with Bing Crosby and Ginger Rogers and stuff like that,
yeah,
is thrown to the wayside to tell very grimy stories. Not only the stories are grimy, but also the way that they're shot.
Yeah, and Robert Altman also is someone to include, because particularly when he filmed crowd scenes, he would like to mic everybody up, and then you get this kind of quite unsettling sense of hearing so many different voices at once.
Okay, so I'm going to be honest. The first time I ever saw you need to be honest when it comes to film history. I fucking hated Robert Altman movies. And especially that, the entire, I remember seeing Nashville for the first time.
Yeah.
And I know how important it is. And I now know how important Altman was for the movies of Paul Thomas Anderson, like Magnolia and Boogie Nights, these ensemble films. Altman was the one to do that first.
By ensemble films, what do you
a
mean?
A lot of different characters portrayed by a lot of good actors, and stories intertwine, and then they fall by the wayside. And yeah, Altman made Nashville and I think The Long Goodbye that I recently saw for the first time.
I want you to take off your clothes.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. I have absolutely nothing to hide either, but I'm not going to take my clothes off.
I want you to get naked so you can tell me the truth about my money.
You want to take your clothes off?
Would you like me to take off my clothes?
It's okay with
me. Why, it's a pleasure. As a matter of fact, everybody, Harry, everybody, take off your clothes.
Wait a minute, Marty. I don't want to take off my clothes. I have too many scars.
I understand. Go on inside, Peppy. Go on inside and take care of the telephone.
The Long Goodbye I had never seen before.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, because I was a big film noir head when I was in my 20s, and I thought if I see another Philip Marlowe portrayal by somebody who's not Humphrey Bogart, I know how this sounds, I'm going to hate it.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love The Long Goodbye. And it actually shows how you can sort of grow into Altman. Because I think the thing with Robert Altman is, so stylistically, what you say is absolutely true. He films crowd scenes and all the dialogue is overlapping, and it kind of feels like reality. If you're in a big room and there's a lot of people talking, you need to sort of pinpoint your ear to them, towards them. So he always mic'd up actors so they could like roam around and you have everybody just talking everywhere. It's mind-boggling to watch a movie like that. But what it does is it turns the movie from a narratively structured thing to what Hugo, our film critic on the podcast, would call a vibe movie. And for the longest time, I didn't understand vibey movies. The Long Goodbye, I just recently saw, is a vibe movie. It's just a guy who's a detective who has a cat, and then his friend does something, and then he is like in a crime plot, but he doesn't know what's going on. You as a viewer, you have no fucking idea what's happening. You don't know who is. Everybody's talking over each other. You don't need to focus. It's not important to know what the story is about. You need to be in the vibe.
Yeah.
You need to just... The entertainment and the art is that you can... And it's interesting because I think that's also something that happens with Altman and Inside and in New Hollywood. There's this shift in how you can narratively engage people.
Mm.
It doesn't have to be like you move from point A to point B. No, it's just like you're just it's the dude with the cat.
There's more character studies, let's say.
Yeah.
And
it's the same with Cassavetes, like a killing of a Chinese bookie. It's not important who killed who.
It took me a long time to come across both Robert Altman and John Cassavetes.
Mm-hmm.
And only now, the more I watch, the more do I understand a little bit of why them being such instrumental figures within American cinema. But I've never really heard someone explain why that is or give enough context to understand their impact. No, not only a new wave, but I think cinema that's followed from that. Because if you are like me and you watch Criterion Closet and you see all these directors, often enough, especially the actors, they will always pick out a Cassavetes film or a Robert Altman film. And they're brilliant films, but I've never still quite understood why they are these cult heroes within American cinema.
Well, I think for those specific two, both of them were very much obsessed with improvisation. What that does is that, especially like the performances by Gina Rowlands, like John Cassavetes' longtime partner and muse. I always kind of hate that word. You can see in their films together that it brings a certain rawness to these movies.
Mm.
You can feel much more life within these films because of it. The way he shoots, as though sometimes the films feel like a documentary and things are handheld. And I was rewatching this scene from A Woman Under the Influence where it's Roland's walking on the street and she's drunk and she's asking people something. You can clearly see that the people on the street have no fucking idea what's going on. They're just there, like they're not actors. It's just he said to her, like, hey, act drunk on the street and we'll shoot you. And it's funny because talking about this, it feels as though, like, how is that new? Well, then it was.
Yeah.
Especially in the sort of technicolor world that America used to know, you know? These lush pictures where everything was very rigid and stuck up, and suddenly you have somebody shooting in almost 16 millimeter on the street, and it's you feel sort of life protruding through the frame. And I mean, I think the same thing with Altman. I think these two, even more than somebody like Scorsese or Hal Ashby, for instance, which I really love as a very underrepresented director or not named enough, I think, in film history. I love Hal Ashby. He made a movie called Being There. Harold and Maude is one of the most well-known films from New Hollywood.
You could say even with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest that it's more about these people and not necessarily a clear, obviously there is a character arc to it, point A to point B, but it's more about just being with these characters and seeing how they live and interact with each other rather than sort of all this over-dramatized action, let's say. Although it does have certain elements still within something like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I understand why it won awards.
Yeah,
because there is still a very emotional arc in that film. That maybe something like The Long Goodbye or more experimental films from this period would lack. Wanda, for instance, by Barbara Loden, which is one of the few films made by a woman or a female director inside the New Hollywood movement.
You come home from work, she's lying around on the couch, kids are dirty, there's diapers on the floor. Sometimes the kids is outside, running around, nobody watching them.
Wanda Goronski.
Listen, Judge, if he wants a divorce, just give it to him.
That's actually quite sad. While making this program, I always try to make these programs as diverse as possible, but sometimes you get very much punished by the reality that emancipation, or especially representation for various walks of life, if I may call it, have been very much underrepresented in some very important movements.
Yeah.
The French New Wave has some female directors.
Mainly
Agnes Varda. New Hollywood has some female directors, but mainly Elaine May and Barbara Loden. The same when it comes to black artists being represented in this movement. We're featuring Claudine.
Incredible film.
Starring the late, great James Earl Jones.
Yeah.
But it's one of the few films that actually fits within the representation of this movement.
Yeah.
What were we talking about? I completely lost track.
You're going to talk about Wanda.
Wanda is a good example of another way of very experimental, very experimental film.
Yeah, but it's maybe good to clarify what we mean as experimental, I think, here, because in New Hollywood, experimental is, I would say, more within the story and the structure of what you're seeing rather than, say, super experimental shots or, it still looks like a film, let's say.
Yeah. There is still a form of narrative structure. We're not talking about very artsy, experimental, avant-garde kind of things. They are very much... I think that's also the reason why many of these films are still very much beloved.
Yeah.
Because they do step away from classic, known American rigid structure of the three-act structure that you learn when you are reading like script books, like the first... I always talk about romantic comedies in this sense. Two people don't know each other. They meet each other. They fall in love. They're doing great. For some reason, they don't like each other anymore. Third act starts. They find each other again. Happy end. So that's how the three-act structure for a romantic comedy usually it works.
Yeah.
And even with movies like When Harry Met Sally, it's fine that it works like that. Works like a charm. There are still elements of that sort of within these films, but they do feel as though they're slowly, they're not as experimental as, for instance, Antonioni started to become, or Italian New Wave, or Godard, or anything. Like a movie like Badlands, for instance, by Terrence Malick. Is Terrence Malick very much before he became incredibly, and even he isn't really experimental, yeah, but the way that he is, his movies sometimes feel like poetry in motion. I think Badlands is like kind of like Godard's Pierrot Le Fou. Two people, they meet each other, they sort of roam the land, they're on the lamb. It's also kind of like Bonnie and Clyde, yeah, but then with nice scenery, if you know what I mean, and some classical music. And it feels a bit more experimental, but it's not radical, you know?
Yeah.
It is radical when you see it within the
context of
where it came from.
And what other sort of are more traditional expected Hollywood films still being made at this time, and can you think of any that we would know? I'm just trying to work out what the state of Hollywood was, rather if it was all in on the new Hollywood movement, or if it was kind of existing next to each other.
That's a good question. I don't know. Do you know this?
No, I don't know.
I have the feeling that the decline of the studios was so far in, they were so deep in the shit that the power shift was more or less complete. In the sense that, you know, even if there is a good answer to this, who gave a shit about these films? Yeah. Because if they really were there, they would have now come to mind for us.
Yeah, that's true.
So maybe there was something like Silent Music 2 that was produced. Silent Music 2 that was produced. But
I'm sure our audience will let us know.
Yeah, send in these terrible films that we are not going to watch.
The only other thing I would say is, obviously you mentioned two female directors, Elaine May and Barbara Loden,
yeah,
and as well as John Berry, the director of Claudine. Yeah. And although, yes, of course, these movements probably didn't have enough representation as they should have done, I still think the movement shows you, though, that it gave space for these kind of directors to emerge and tell stories that are mm-hmm. personal to their experience in ways that Hollywood hadn't allowed before.
Oh, 100%. I think the funny thing is, if you look at this movement and what I said about as a curating, you get punished by history because it's simply those histories are not there. It is better than what it was before. If you zoom out a bit, it was worse. Like the studio system, there was no real room for black artists or artists from different backgrounds. And this does sow the seed for more representation in a broader sense. I will say, though, Elaine May, who's still not known enough if you look at how this film history is being represented. I think now the name Elaine May is somebody who's come up only in the past maybe 10 to 20 years or something. She made a film that is called A New Leaf, which is more or less one of the few comedies, really, from this period. She plays in it herself, opposite Walter Matthau, who's also a very well-known actor. She was still very much being battled by the studio. I think it was Paramount. So Paramount didn't give her all the freedom. They gave all the men more freedom than they gave Elaine May on this one. Yeah, and eventually, I think she, funnily enough, also destroyed her career a bit by making a big movie eventually that was this big epic. I can't remember the name.
Ishtar,
thank you. Yeah. One of the biggest flops, I think, in that period. But Elaine May must be celebrated, if only, I would say, for her work together with Mike Nichols, another very important director from the movement who made The Graduate and Carnal Knowledge and a lot of other very important films. She also wrote the screenplay for The Birdcage with Robin Williams. Which was directed by Mike Nichols, and which is one of the funniest screenplays and one of the funniest films I've ever seen. For some reason, she is very much a credit more than she is credited enough within in her influence in this movement.
So, Tom, we have been discussing a lot of cult figures within this movement, but there have been a few names we have kind of been skirting around or avoiding mentioning, but I think it's probably worth us diving into them. Also part of the new Hollywood movement is, of course, George Lucas with American Graffiti.
His name as though he's a criminal. George Lucas.
Well, we're going to find out why. Of course, he went on to direct the big Hollywood blockbusters, Star Wars franchise. And
never heard of those movies.
You also have Martin Scorsese. And, of course, you seem to say Steven Spielberg also fits into this movement, which I'm not so convinced, but maybe you can briefly explain why. But yeah, I think it's interesting to look at, I would say, the demise of this movement, the new Hollywood movement, which comes about in the late 70s, maybe early 80s, depends who you ask. I think it's very much a consequence of people like George Lucas.
This is a personal vindictive battle that you're in now.
This is someone who's never really watched Star Wars as well, either. Yeah, maybe you could give some context as to why I'm calling these three out. First, by explaining...
Why do I need to give context why you're these three?
How first Steven Spielberg fits into this, but how these directors came from New Hollywood and why they were encouraged...
Okay. So George Lucas made a small movie called American Graffiti. And American Graffiti is very much a film that's considered New Hollywood.
Special one, and jump into your candy-colored custom or your screaming machine, cruise downtown and catch American Graffiti.
American Graffiti? Baby, what's that?
It's a movie.
Scorsese, I would almost say, he made Taxi Driver, which is seen as one of the most important films in the movement.
You talking to me?
Coppola, it's the same thing. He made The Conversation. He made The Godfather. Okay, it's mentioned.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
I now want to make that Barbie joke. Have I told you that The Godfather is my favorite movie? They are very much influential figures. They're also all, because it's important to mention this in relation to New Hollywood, also to the French New Wave. A part of this, they're all auteurs. They are, as you said before, filmmakers that brought their own signature and their own voice to these films. And you can see a clear through line in the films that they make. They're their movies. They're not as the guys that I mentioned before, like the Victor Flemings of these world hired guns. They have their own voice in these films. Then what happens, I think, is that these smaller films, you can clearly see in all these guys, the movie brats, their careers, they start stacking these smaller films with bigger movies. And the one that I haven't mentioned yet, who I do think is an author, but is an author that would make a film that would then be the first summer blockbuster ever, is the man called Steven Spielberg. Now, Spielberg, just like John Frankenheimer, who was also a very important name from this period, who made Midnight Cowboy, came from television. And television, I think, is a very important thing to name here as well, because the reason why younger audiences were looking for a new thrill and then were happy that this was the movement that spoke to them is that television was a thing.
Yeah.
There was TV, and on TV sometimes there were things being done that were more interesting than the old Hollywood system was doing. Yeah. And maybe we'll come later to how there's maybe an echo, parallel in what's going on right now with a younger generation. But Spielberg came from television. I think he directed the Columbo episode, and he directed something else, and then he got some money together to make Jewel, a movie of a guy escaping a very angry truck. I can't describe this movie in any other way. It's fantastic, by the way. It's the least Spielberg movie you've ever seen, made by Steven Spielberg. But I think the films that he made after that, leading up to Jaws, because that's the big movie that would sort of almost have Hollywood reemerge from the waters, is the films that he made before are... Yeah, they are independent. They can be seen as a bit more grimy than the E.T., the extraterrestrial. We'd very much become a more slick filmmaker. I think that's the reason why you would say that maybe he's not part of the system.
Yeah.
Or this movement. But he kind of is. I think, although, you know, what happened is that, and that's why you name Lucas, as though he's this big, criminal kind of guy. They start making movies that are almost the same problem as the movies that came before, in a way.
because Star Wars came out in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
So just at the end of the new Hollywood movement. But like you said, you see a return to a very clear distinction of good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, this sort of like big production
right.
scale where, like you said, I guess as TV is becoming, entering people's homes, people are getting familiar with it. What is going to take you to the cinema? And probably the bigger, the better, the more entertained you are, the more bang for your buck
mm-hmm.
you are going to get perhaps as an audience. But I guess it showed and it gave, again, an incentive to studios to change their strategy again, obviously for economic purposes of, oh, if we invest more money into these bigger scale productions again, people are going to return to it.
Which is fascinating because I think Star Wars wasn't made for a lot.
No.
So the return of investment was, I think, the thing that they were like, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We do the thing again where we try to produce it lean, and then that slowly, because Jaws is another, you know, movie that wasn't made for a lot of money, but the return of investment on that was insane.
Yeah.
So what happens then? And then the investment starts to become bigger and the movie becomes bigger. And then we almost return to the same hollow bullshit of trying to and I by the way I am not saying dear listeners that Star Wars is hollow bullshit, you know,
I might be.
Elliot doesn't know because he's never seen a fucking Star Wars movie.
I can't argue with that. There are political and social parallels that need to be mentioned on picked up on of why we're returning to this, let's say, or why we're returning to these more entertainment-based films. So the 60s and 70s, they're highly political, highly social periods of great social movements, etc. And people are becoming perhaps more aware, so they want those films to reflect how they're feeling and how they're thinking, and they want people to try and make sense of that. The 80s, I would say, is perhaps the hangover of this, of realizing that despite all the efforts that we went to change things, that everything is still kind of the same. And so then after perhaps 10, 15 years of watching films dealing with these issues, you get a bit tired of it as an audience, perhaps, or being reminded of how shit social conditions are. And this is then in the 80s, the rise of Reaganism and neoliberalism, that then people see cinema more as an escapism. So then films like
Arnold, we get to the chopper.
Exactly. And that's where I think blockbusters thrive. And I think maybe this then draws us to the next part of why the parallels are so clear today between the world in which we live in and when American New Wave first popped up, of how perhaps we have felt for some time that these blockbusters, as you said, are hollow. But more the marvelization of films, of these big blockbusters, of this just total bullshit of clear good and evil American propaganda, of trying to uplift again this notion of an American dream. And why or how is cinema going to respond to all of this now, would you say?
Well, the thing... Jesus, lay that on me, baby. The thing to ask here is, and where are we in the wave?
Yeah.
Because you can see that there is clear returning waves in the evolution of, I think, any art form, really. But clear waves where you can also say, sadly, history is repeating itself.
Yes.
For God's sake. So... are we now, I'm sort of re-asking you the question, I think, but are we now at the same point of, or maybe a bit further in the point of where we were with the big studio systems making these stupid big-ass movies, are we now at the precipice of a new generation that needs to hit us with movies that show us the grimy reality?
Yeah.
Are we there? The interesting thing is here, because I was thinking, if this is starting to turn into a rhetorical question for some reason, that was not what I wanted to do. But you would want to see movies that really kick against your shins, right?
Yeah.
Or kick against the shins of what's happening.
Yes.
Are those movies being made? Apart from maybe something like, maybe one battle after another.
Yeah.
But that is a movie made by a studio.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a Warner Brothers film. So
Yeah, my Letterboxd comment after watching it for the second time is that the revolution isn't going to be televised on VistaVision paid for by Warner Bros. But I think we're not there yet. I would say, like, with films like One Battle After Another, I've spoken a bit about this already, Eddington, Borgogna, these are kind of films where filmmakers are starting to come to a sense of, oh, I have to respond to the times in which we live in. Mm-hmm. But I don't see them as radical films. Maybe a bit radical in the content because there isn't much out there at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still waiting to see what independent cinema is going to do. How is it going to respond? What is going to be the new form or language that it takes to deal with this? Because still at the moment, most films I've seen, maybe Radu Jude, he's one person that I think is pushing, he's this Romanian director, mm-hmm. and he's starting to experiment with different forms of like film language, let's say, mm-hmm. and breaking it down. But apart from that, I haven't really seen anyone that's taking significant risks or that's showing me that there is something new starting to emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it will take a little bit of time.
Because now you're mentioning a European filmmaker, so
yes,
I mean, I think that outside of America, there are interesting things happening. Yes. I think we should pinpoint it a bit more towards, to how America right now is in a climate of poop.
Yeah, to put it mildly.
To put it mildly, and they are on the precipice of dictatorship.
Yeah,
or
authoritarianism.
Authoritarianism,
social collapse.
Yes, and well, let's just turn it into a movie reference. America has never been as close to Mike Judge's idiocracy in the history of cinema.
Yeah,
and I think that can there be a cultural rising up or a cultural critique? Is it even possible right now for a different group than you would see now on the news? And I'm maybe talking about right-wing America or conservative America or how you ever want to call it.
I think it's a good question because, if we look within America, I would say what they have done well is capturing independent filmmakers and consuming them or assuming them into these studio productions. Because if you look at Ari Aster, Paul Thomas Anderson, they first started out as very much independent filmmakers. And I think within that space, perhaps they would have pushed even Ryan Coogler actually as well. And that's my worry. I don't see, or I can't think of American independent filmmakers that are getting a platform or are able to find ways to show their films that gives access to an audience to experience something different to them.
There's a positive and a negative aspect to the studios seeing the potential of an independent filmmaker. So somebody in a boardroom meeting is looking at Frances Ha and goes, let's give her Lady Bird.
Yeah.
Or let's have Noah Baumbach, you know. And then eventually, let's have Greta Gerwig direct Barbie.
Yeah.
I think there is something interesting in that sense. I think it's interesting to have Yorgos Lanthimos make a film that's then, I mean, probably not even completely made by with Universal money, but it's released by Universal. There are good sides to that. It does give smaller filmmakers. There is still some auteur thingy going there, you know. But then again, there is no real middle ground anymore. There is no where is the $20 million movie made by somebody you've never really heard of who was you know, and those movies, and especially
Sean Baker is also a great example of how he's
exactly
for a long time an independent filmmaker and now
what I will say though, because Sean Baker is an interesting thing that you mention him, I do think that if there is something changing, within maybe the what is next after what the studios are doing now.
Yeah.
It's A24. It's Neon. It's...
Yes.
But the issue is that A24 now itself is also becoming a studio.
Yeah, yeah.
In a sense, that is good because there needs to be a new player on the spectrum. But to make it maybe a bit too industry inside. There is things now shifting. There is talks about the acquisition of Warner Brothers by Skydance, which is this huge corporation. And Netflix also did a bid on Warner and blah, blah. What the real future here is when it comes to these big studio players and if they can still... What I hope is that even if the corporatization of these big players comes to the weird zenith where it's, yeah. you know, now Disney owns Fox and that destroyed the Fox Searchlight label, which were these very small, nice drama movies that now are like falling to the wayside. Yeah. All of Us Strangers was one of the films that they made quite recently. But they are far in between. Even if that does happen, then you would hope that there is this uprising from the lower echelons of independent American cinema to challenge that or to show you a different side of how to do things. And that might also not be, and I hate to say this because we're here at a cinema, that might even not be in a cinema. That might be the moving image might evolve on a different platform first, maybe. Yeah. Whether that be on TikTok or on streaming, or maybe it needs to be instigated on a different platform to then influence cinema again, as the new wave did first, you know, the French new wave or the Italian new wave.
I do see some people making films specifically to release on YouTube, and then it builds an audience, and then that gives them the platform or credibility to then get money from studios.
Yeah.
And they're often quite young filmmakers. So I'm curious what that does.
YouTuber Chris Stuckman just directed Shelby Oaks, a new horror movie.
Is it Together? No, which is the film by the two YouTube brothers? Two YouTube brothers, they're Australian, they make horror films. You know, you screened it here.
Is that not Together?
No. It's the other one with the kids.
Oh, it's a bring her back.
Yeah,
bring her back. They got picked up by A24. Yeah.
I would say two things maybe to end on this is that ultimately in the end, it's great that independent filmmakers are being given a chance within studio systems, because then it kind of, for me, kills a bit the Marvelization of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And we're actually
that's a move for them to then stop making these...
Yeah.
Avengers 15.
We're getting better blockbusters if you want to, because I think you can now call films like Anora, Poor Things, these are now kind of blockbusters because of the scale of, and Challengers even, and because of they're so big and their marketing campaigns and all of this.
Right.
But because now A24 has become a studio almost as big as some of these other studios, there's no A24 to replace A24. There's no place for people like Sean Baker, Yorgos Lanthimos to be nurtured or given the space to experiment. And I think that's where I'm waiting to see what's going to happen for a new wave of filmmakers to emerge, to bring a new language or to just respond more directly, I would say, to the climate in America.
Mm-hmm. There are some companies there that might give A24 a run for their money, But you'd hope that, I don't know. What is your hope, really? What is the movie that you want to see?
That's a good question. I think I want to see a film that not only encaptures how we feel, but also, and that's the thing I have the biggest issue with. There's no film that offers a sense of hope. Not that all films should always offer a sense of hope, but an idea or some kind of imagining of what a radical alternative could be, or how do we fight this, or what are the answers? And I'm not expecting directors to always have the answers, but to start a conversation
or at least challenge it.
I think there's enough, you see enough people having these conversations in day-to-day life or in other modes of culture that I feel film is lacking there. And then it makes me start to wonder, is film becoming apolitical when in reality it has always been political? And that is probably what I hope for. Something just to kickstart something else. Because I think, as you've seen throughout history, films have always responded to the times in which they're in, and vice versa. They've always been influencing each other. Yeah. And I think right now we're a bit separated between these two.
I agree.
What about you?
I'm not. I do not have a better answer for this. No, really. I think it's a beautiful and uplifting and also saddening answer in the sense that you do. I always keep thinking of during COVID. I was watching the documentary series "Can't Get You Out of My Head" by Adam Curtis, like eight to 9 hours long, and it ends with a quote I can't remember from whom, but he with the beautiful Adam Curtis voice, he quotes a scientist or something, and the scientist says, "The great secret of the world is that we've made it, and we can easily make it differently."
Yes,
this must be a misquote, but something like that. There is a way of doing things differently. We just need to sort of slightly grasp, I do think that's interesting, and I sometimes when I'm watching films, I feel like we might just be there almost to do it, but we're not really there yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's hope that there's interesting times ahead.
Yeah, and I think the best way, as always, is by going back to the past and seeing what has come before, which. A selfless plug, but that's why I'm going to be watching as many of these American New Hollywood films here at Lab 111. But I think there are answers to be found in the films that we have been discussing, and at least ideas of what we can hope to see in the coming years. So, yeah. Is there a film you would recommend that people wouldn't... I think on that list of films that you have your classics like Midnight Cowboy, Bonnie and Clyde, etc., The Conversation, of course, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but is there a film on there that you would perhaps spotlight for people to go and seek out and watch whilst it's screening at Lab?
The thing I'm going to do is I'm going to name a film that we haven't discussed, which is very important, which relates very much towards... it's Network by... Jesus.
Sidney Lumet.
Sidney Lumet. Yeah, it's a fantastic film about funnily enough, about television, and about a presenter who starts losing his mind, and the television network thinking, you know what, we're going to keep him on, because that's quite interesting.
He's losing his mind, but gaining popularity because he says exactly what he feels.
Exactly, so. And the saying exactly what you feel is something that has become, it's called... populism.
Yeah.
it is, if you look at it, watch it now, you see how politicians function, especially populist politicians function on television, and also how media is super obsessed with those sort of shouty. There is everything needs to be a clickbait. Yeah, but I mean, there's so much there. It's hard to pick one specifically. I'm very proud that we're doing this.
Yeah, I'm very happy that you have Claudine by John Barry.
I'm very happy it's there. I think it's important to screen it.
I've seen it. It's a great film. It's an incredible film. It's about a single mother trying to raise her children, a black American single mother, and how the system is against her, basically, of not wanting to support her, of almost punishing her for having children, but also of how she's also just a woman wanting to find love and to be cherished. And it's a very sweet, tender, human-centered film and the score is by Curtis Mayfield as well, so it's incredible to
watch.
That's a banger. But thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzall and artwork from Studio FFF.